Well, faithful fans, we have been promising this for a while, and so we have now finally had the time to sit down and record our first episode talking about facilities. So without further ado, let's kick this thing off. And I am James Dibben, and welcome to the Hospice Nursing Podcast. Well, hello, fellow hospice nurses all over America, and welcome to your show. That's right, this is the only show, at least that I could find, that provides practical help for hospice nursing success. I am your host, James Dibben, with ConfessionsOfAHospiceNurse.net, and thank you for joining us today, and welcome to your show. And so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time bloviating as I tend to do here in the beginning, because we have got a special guest with us today that I have touted for too long. But this is a hardworking man that we have with us today. And so I'm excited to have him here, and he can be hard to hunt down, but that's because he takes care of the people that he works with. And so I want to welcome Brian from the Hospice Nurse Support Group. Brian, welcome to the show.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on here, James. And I'm excited to be here. It's been a while getting here. We had set up a time and a date. And, of course, life happens. And life happens at work. But we're not going to dwell on that. We're going to jump right into the meat of things here and see what we can do here.
Right, right. So one thing I wanted to mention as we start to get into the meat of this episode is, while we're going to address a whole bunch of questions from the Hospice Nurse Support Group, this episode will not become a complain about facilities episode. Our goal, as always with the show, is to provide you with those practical tools that you need to be successful. So our goal today is understanding the challenges an ALF may face and how we can help them be more successful with the patients that we care for together. And in hospice, the word collaboration is a very important word. And that word does not go away when we deal with facilities and staff and families and anybody. I mean, what we do every single day is collaborate with everybody involved in the patient's care to the patient's best interest. And so to kind of get this show and episode up and going, I always like to take a moment to hear the hospice story of our guest, assuming they have one. And Brian, you certainly do. So I would really enjoy to hear a little bit about your personal hospice story.
All right. Well, I come from humble beginnings here, as everybody does. Was in another type of nursing and then transitioned into hospice. My background right from the get-go was emergency nursing. Mm. I worked in several emergency rooms, transitioned into the ICU. And my last job before I moved over into hospice, I was working in a surgical ICU. Mm. I took care of open heart patients. I took care of surgeries that went wrong. My idea of a good time was having a really sick patient on multiple drips and the vent and maybe a balloon pump. And the sicker they were, the more happier I was. And I know that sounds kind of strange, doesn't it? But while I was doing that, I started noticing some things. And what I was noticing is that doctors were ordering procedures and tests that really weren't relevant to the outcome of a patient. For instance, we'd have someone come in with a brain bleed and had a MRI and they were on a vent and multiple drips and such as that. And the neurologist would want to get another MRI just to see if the bleed had progressed. And eventually I started challenging that. Well, why do we need another MRI? Well, I want to see what's happening inside the head. Well, are we going to treat things any differently? No. Is the outcome the same? Is the patient probably going to succumb? Well, yeah, I believe he's going to pass. And so it's like, well, why are we going to tie up four nurses to go down to an MRI to put this patient in a tube under sedation and tie up the nurses for a couple of hours and the staff in the MRI just so we know if the brain swelling is getting worse or not? That's one of the more drastic examples. But, you know, I started challenging that, and I started challenging my thoughts and thinking about the patient and what these tests were doing to the patients and the families. And then I had that $500,000 back injury where it wasn't enough to put me out of nursing, but it was enough to affect how I was nursing. They would pair me up with an aide to do the heavy lifting and the turning and stuff, but they wouldn't pair me up with the same aide. And so by the time I explained what I needed when a patient was getting in trouble, I was ending up doing it myself. And eventually I was to the point where I couldn't work in intensive care anymore. And during that time, I started talking with a couple of hospice nurses, and I thought, boy, that sounds kind of interesting. And so I talked some more and decided to, you know, a casual position in a hospice team did come up. And I started working casual while I was in the ICU and found that it was a good fit. And they actually created a position for me in hospice. So I moved into hospice, and I was there for about 17 years.
Wow. 17 years. And what roles did you, perform in during those 17 years as a nurse?
I was RN case manager. And when they said, you want to be an RN case manager? I said, sure. What do they do? And the hospice team had only been there for, I think, about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And so they were still exploring their role. And this was in the in the early 2003, I moved into hospice. And basically, RN case managers, they called everybody an RN case manager at that time. So I had my own team, and with the aides, and of course with the chaplains and social workers and bereavement people. And we started out as a small team, and I remember everybody complaining that, you know, I couldn't go out and do more admissions because we had 19 people, and it was just stressing everybody out. When I left, we had 75 people, and we were still growing. So
wow,
I got to watch the growth of a hospice team, got to watch the changes in hospice. It went from the more laid back support, making sure a person was comfortable, to becoming a little bit more aggressive in patient care and patient comfort, and watching the changes that developed there. And some of those changes are part of what caused me to move away from hospice. You know, we hear a lot of statements today about the hospice nurses being overworked, the hospice nurses not being heard, and some of those things. Those were some of the issues that we were dealing with at that time.
Well, thank you for sharing that story with us and just giving us some insight into what has brought you, you know, what brought you through hospice and even why you left. So I'm curious, because obviously we didn't know each other until the Hospice Nurse Support Group on Facebook. And once again, I'll make sure I'll link I'll put a link to that in the show notes, but I think a lot of the audience from there, you know, a pretty decent amount of them listen to this show, but you're one of the moderators in there. So tell me kind of how you fit into the story of that hospice nurse support group.
Well, it's kind of interesting. There are several support groups out there, or hospice groups out there. And I'm just going to name one group because we were a part of that group. And it was called the Hospice Nursing Group. And several of us in there were frustrated because there was really no control over who was coming into the group and some of the information that was being shared around and passed around was maybe a little bit less than pure, a little bit non-accurate. We had people who weren't hospice nurses coming in as what I say is posers. A lot of people advertising for jobs, and they were starting to get spammed up and everything. And several of the members kept trying to contact the moderators to kind of give them a heads up about it. And out of frustration, one day, I forget who said it first. I don't remember if it was Chris or myself, but we said, you know, we really ought to form our own group. And Chris said, well, you know, I'm willing to be the administrator for that group if we do it. And so a bunch of us formed that group, and I'm a founding member of the group. And Chris, bless her heart, ran it as the sole administrator for quite a while.
Then
we were messaging back and forth one day, and she said, hey, I forget the exact words, but it was something like, I like your style. You're, you know, kind of a calm person and reasonable and stuff. And would you be interested in being a moderator? And I said, sure. So we started out. I remember, I think in that first month we had, I don't know, a couple of hundred people in there. And I didn't look at the stats lately, but I think we're up over 10 grand, aren't we? Well over 10 grand.
Oh, yeah. It's up to over 14 now.
Okay.
So a lot.
So, and that's been several years, and we're choosy about who we let in. Mm-hmm. We did have some people sneak in under the wire, they came in and they started getting snapshots of our group, copying some of the things we were talking about, and posting them into anti-hospice sites groups. And again, I'm going to mention one group in particular just because the way that they did it was just so covert. And Chris and I took a lot of time. We went name by name with our group, with this other group, and found, I believe, like 14 or 15 people.
Wow.
That were in this death by hospice, and all these quotes and screenshots from our group were popping up. And so we weeded those out. And so a lot of people over the years have been kind of upset because we've been kind of strict on our rules. And when we're in doubt, we turn somebody down. And then they can reapply and give a little bit more evidence that they are truly hospice nurses and stuff. But I think it's served us well. Our goal is to protect our membership, and I think we've done well.
I would totally agree. I think you all have done very well. I've been blessed to be invited as a moderator and follow your all's lead. And you mentioned everybody, you know, you mentioned yourself and Chris being laid back, and that's absolutely the case. And I feel like it's interesting that's kind of the moderator core are laid back people. And I guess the reason to pick folks like that is because we tend to not jump down people's throats right away. And you don't need that from your leadership. You need leadership that leads by kindness and care for others. And so I think that's kind of evident, at least from what I see, you know, from the, from backstage, so to speak. So,
correct. And that's something that a lot of people don't see as the backstage part of it, where we're back channeling each other and discussing things. And And sometimes we get a little bit intense in our own discussions over, you know, some of the stuff, whether we should allow it to go through or you know, give it a chance and see where it goes. There have been a lot of times where we've seen posts on there that we're really not comfortable with. And a couple of us will want to say, well, let's not let it go. And then a couple others of us will say, why don't we just let this go and see where it runs and just keep an eye on it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we've had some fantastic exchanges, some really good ideas come out of the exchanges. Other times it just got down to a bashing session where people didn't like what somebody said and they just pile on, and we have to go in there and either shut commenting down for a while or every once in a while remove some people from the conversation and mute them for a few days. I think in the time that we've had our group, the number of people that we've removed from the group because of their actions and stuff, probably, I'm going to guess, maybe about 20.
Yeah, it's not very many.
It's not very many at all, especially for a group well over 10,000.
Yeah. Well, and today's show is kind of a good example of that, because we went ahead and posted. You know, we're pretty, we keep a real close eye on any type of, you know, posting and conversation around nursing facilities, because we, as a moderator group, and you guys started this long before I came around, we're just careful about bashing other areas of nursing. We're not fans of it. We don't believe that it is good for our patients, and we don't believe that it is good for us as professionals either. It doesn't progress us down the road. But we went ahead. I got permission from the moderator group, because if I post something, it just goes in automatic. So I try to really watch myself, because people don't, you know, we don't moderate each other's posts. It just goes right in. And so I got permission from the group when you and I talked about doing a show like this. Let's ask the community what questions they might have. And Chris was the first one to reply in there and say, I'm keeping an eye on this to make sure it doesn't get out of control. And it really didn't. I feel like we got a lot of good questions.
We did. We got quite a few duplicates, maybe not worded the same way, but the same general concept. And so there were, I can't even remember how many there were. And we pared them down. We probably got maybe 10, 12 really good, solid questions, or, you know, and that kind of represented the general feeling of the population that responded. It's kind of interesting, when we did start looking at not knocking other nursing disciplines, especially when it came to ALFs and long-term facility. I had a lot of people message me saying, you know, we don't think it's right that you're controlling the conversation here, and we don't think this is what the group is about. And some of them did leave. They remain friends with me on Facebook, and I talk with a lot of them even today. But just the strong emotion about that, they felt like their voice wasn't being heard. And it was being heard, but it just, the presentation just wasn't proper. And after suggestions on maybe how to reword it or how to change a couple of words so that it wasn't quite as offensive, they just didn't want to. They didn't want to play nice in the sandbox, so to speak, and so they chose to remove themselves from the group.
Well, and something we don't do, and you can't do in a group of 14,000 people, is we don't, you know, hunt down everybody and make sure they're still working in hospice. And so people who are in this group may have left hospice or retired or gone to long-term care or whatever, and the last thing they need to do is pop in and see what it is they're trying to do as a nurse, getting bashed all the time. And that wouldn't be fun either. You know, none of us want to join the murdered by hospice group because they're in there bashing us all the time. So, you know, let's not build a group that spends a whole lot of time tearing them down. And my hope is that today with this episode that we can begin to provide tools to anyone who's listening to this so they can be more successful in the facilities and not dread going into them. Because that's not what we want to see for everybody. I had it here on question three about why you transitioned away from hospice, but I think you kind of answered that when you shared your story. So I feel like maybe at this point it would be beneficial to jump to number four, where I ask you to give kind of an overall review of an ALF and its function, because with all of those questions that came in, it didn't take long for us to figure out we had two shows, that we were going to have to break it up into long-term care versus ALF. And especially I wanted to start with the ALF one because that's what you're doing right now, right? Tell me how, I guess it is important to talk about why you chose ALF after finishing hospice. So why don't you do that? So kind of handle three there and then tell us, you know, give us your idea of what an ALF is supposed to be.
Right. You know, in addition to having frustrations with the changes that were coming about in the hospice field, I was hitting definite burnout. I live in a small rural community up in northeastern Minnesota. And for anybody who wants to find out where I live, if you pull out a map and look for Duluth, Minnesota, and I know I say Minnesota funny, but that's just the way it is. And you go straight north about 60 miles, you'll see a town called Virginia. And from there, if you go east about 20 miles, you'll see another small town called Aurora, which is even smaller. And then if you go south of Aurora a little bit, you're going to see a little area called Palo, P-A-L-O. Well, that's kind of where I live right now. And I grew up in the Aurora area. And when I was in hospice, for the longest time, that was my area of service. And when I took that service area over, like I said, our hospice had only been around for a couple of years. And while I was a casual and doing admissions, we had a couple of nurses that worked this area. And they didn't have a very good reputation. They had a reputation of doing whatever they wanted, regardless of what the primary physician wanted. And something that really hit me when I first started covering the area was one of the doctors that I kind of admired for her skills was in a nursing home I was at one night. And I came in and had a patient that was just in excruciating pain. And I said, can I suggest that we switch to a liquid morphine? And I said, typically, I never said we should use this, we should use that. I said, typically, we start out with this amount and then titrate it up every hour until we get them comfortable. And she said, why not? You hospice people do whatever you want. And that kind of struck a chord with me. And she was not a very good advocate for hospice. And I found that kind of in the community as well. And so I worked hard and worked to find out what people wanted and everything. And in a matter of about 2 years, I turned from being that damn hospice nurse to being, hey, I want you to meet our community hospice nurse. Mm-hmm. And that kind of made me feel good. But growing up in this community, I moved away when I was in the Marine Corps, and then through my adventures in nursing, and I came back. When I started in hospice, coming into my own home area, I started out taking care of parents of my friends. Mm-hmm. And as I went on, I started taking care of friends and classmates. One of the hardest ones was one of the guys I was in Boy Scouts with. I took care of him through his cancer and several classmates and stuff like that. And it finally got to the point where I was taking care of one of my dad's best friends, and we had a really good relationship, you know, before him coming on to hospice, and that was very hard on me. And so they moved me to another service area, and it was up north of Virginia, probably about 20, 30 miles. And one of my first patients there was my cousin's best friend, and where I had a relationship. And after doing this for quite a while, I got burnt out. It was hard to see people I grew up with dying, and finally I started burning out. And in my adventures, I know I'm kind of going long here, but in my adventures, I serviced several ALFs and several nursing homes, as well as having in-home patients. And there was one that I struck up a really good rapport with, and one of the nurses that was there, I knew her as she was as an aide, and then an LPN, and then an RN. And I would go into her part of the facility, and when she was an LPN, she just had a traumatic thing happen with one of her patients, and she didn't have an RN available in the building at the time. I said, I'll go ahead and help you take care of this. And she remembered that. She remembered that I was willing to go out of my way to help her out with one of her residents and making sure that he was okay, and determining he didn't have to go to the hospital and such as that. Well, anyways, I was over there one day seeing some patients, and she said, you know, we've got an opening over here. I said, oh? She said, yeah, we need a RN manager over in the assisted living side of it. She worked in the memory care side of it. And she just kind of hemmed and hawed around about it, and just kind of mentioned it three or four times. And after having frustrations at work and feeling like I wasn't in a good place there, I called her up. I said, is that position still open? And she said, yeah, but we're getting ready to close on it and decide who we're going to hire. And I said, well, I just want you to know I'm going to put in my resume. And she said, I won't tell anybody. And I filled out my resume and sent it by email at 10 o'clock. At 10:20, I got a phone call from the clinical services director and set up an appointment for 1:30 for a job interview. And basically, they told me about the job. And I said, well, I suppose you've got some questions for us. And I'm sitting there with four RNs and three LPNs. And they said, no, we know you. We know how you talk with people. We know what your thought process is. We already know about you. We just want to tell you about the job and everything. And then the nurses got up and left, and we started talking about salary. And she made a proposal, and I made a counter proposal. She said, I'll have to talk with my higher ups. And I said, okay. I said, just give me a call when you think you know what you want. And by 4 o'clock that afternoon, I had got hired into that facility. I chose that facility because of the teamwork that the nurses had and the interactions that I had and the good feelings I had when I worked with the nurses in that facility. And I've been there for about 3.5 years now.
Wow. Wow. Well, tell us what your overall view of an ALF is and what its function is.
Okay. A lot of people think that a assisted living facility is much like a nursing home, and it's not. Basically, what an assisted living facility is, it's a building. We call ours a community, and our community has a lot of apartments in it.
Yeah.
I can't tell you exactly how many, and we've got a good breakdown of apartments or units. Some are what we call companion units, where two people live in one unit. They both have their own bedroom, and then they have a common area, and they share a bathroom, and they've got a kitchenette and all of that. And then we have what's called a studio apartment, which is just how it sounds. It's a one bedroom or a one room unit where you can have a bed and an easy chair, or maybe a small couch or something. You got your TV, you got a little kitchenette, your bathroom and such. Then we have one bedroom units, and we have a couple of two bedroom units. And we actually also have an independent living unit attached to our assisted living, which are beautiful, beautiful units. And Some of them have fireplaces, two bedrooms, a utility room. They can have washers and dryers in there and such as that. So basically, we are in the, I won't say real estate business, but we are in the rental business. Mm. But we bring in people who aren't necessarily normal renter people. We have people that have needs. Some of them need nursing oversight. Some need medication management. A lot of them need to have food prep done. They can fix stuff in their kitchenette, but we've got a very large dining room. We have a small one as well, but the small one's closed right now because we just can't get the staff to open the second dining room right now. Mm-hmm. And so when people move in, they sign a contract for their units. And then we as nurses, we go in and we assess their needs. We find out what needs that they have, and we make a contract that we are going to provide these services for in return for this rate for this amount of services. Mm. And I've seen some people in the group post that people on medical assistance or on county waivers and stuff like that can't live in an assisted living. And that is not true. I can't tell you the exact percentage of people that we have that are, a lot of their funding is paid by the county. And these are people who, if they didn't have the access to the assisted living through a county waiver, an elderly waiver, or a waiver for people with needs, medical needs, these are the people who would be living in the streets or living in these really run-down apartments that don't have heat, don't have running water, and stuff like that. So we also provide a service in the community by providing those units. And the companion units are, that's what that they're designed for. They're for the people who are on the county and they have needs, but they don't have a lot of money. And interestingly enough, we've got four of those companion units right now have been rented out to couples because they want to sleep in separate bedrooms. Mm. So it's kind of interesting, our mix.
Right.
We've got quite a few of caddy waivers and elderly waivers in the studio apartments as well.
So I want to ask you a couple of questions here. Some of the practices that I've had over the years that I do, there's one thing I do the same, whether I'm going into an ALF or to a long-term care facility. And it's just my own rule that I have is when I walk in the door, I try to always find the nurse. And when I say nurse, I generally mean RN, LPN, like, you know, a nurse. And then I ask them, how's the patient? Any changes? Do you have any concerns you need me to check out? Then I'll go and see the patient and do my assessment. And then I'll return back to the nurse and give that nurse my findings. And then if I have any recommendations or suggestions, I'll discuss it with them. As somebody who's done hospice a lot longer than many of the people who are going to listen to this, and certainly longer than me, Is that a healthy activity when you walk in first? Like, you know, do you have any changes to that, or just tell me your thoughts on something like that?
No, I agree with you wholeheartedly. Number one, you need to let us know what day you're coming, and number two, you need to give us a time frame of when you're going to be there. A nurse is a nurse as far as workload goes. And we're just as busy in an assisted living as a hospice nurse is, as an ICU nurse is, as a oncology or a nephrology nurse is. And if you want to spend a few quality minutes with us, we're more than glad to carve out a little bit of time, but just don't surprise us. Mm. In fact, in the CMS guidelines, it specifically says that you're supposed to care plan for the day you are going to visit a facility. And if you're going to deviate that, you need to call and notify the facility. And while I was a hospice nurse, I kind of thought that was a little bit of hogwash. But being in the assisted living facility, I understand why that's in there for continuity of care. But when the RN comes into our facility, best practice is to find the RN. And what I started doing before my LPN left is making sure that she was in on the conversations that we had as much as possible, because if I wasn't away, or if I was away to where I couldn't meet with the hospice nurse, my LPN had a good understanding of what was going on. And actually, my LPNs have a better understanding of a lot of things that are going on than I do, because I just don't have the time to get my nose into everything.
Right.
My LPN left about 2 years ago, I would say, year and a half, 2 years ago. And we had trouble filling that position, and I'm happy to say that I've got a new LPN that's out of training, and she is a new LPN. She just graduated from LPN school. My advantage is that in her prior profession, she was involved with the psych field, which works well with my end of the building, and we'll get into that in a little bit when I talk about resident mix. But I like to have the LPNs. Number one, they're kind of the pulse of, they've got their thumb on the pulse of the community. But the other thing too is, if they feel like they're a part of what's going on, you're going to get more buy-in from them.
Very good.
And so I have them in with that. I always encourage them to talk to my aide that's working the floor with their patients to get up to the minute of what's going on, because they're going to tell you, yeah, I was in with Betsy Ross, and she's had a couple of loose stools today, and her mentation's a little bit off, and we were going to ask, we were thinking of maybe asking you for a UA to, you know, see what's going on there, and have a talk with them, because they can give you the up to the minute scoop. And they also feel the buy-in on it.
Right.
And so they feel a part of a team, and that helps you as a hospice nurse to start building relationships.
Yeah. Relationships, so important. Well, it's interesting you talk about us having a routine at the facility, and if we're not going to follow that routine to call, and you know, we should do the same thing with our home patients. But I think it's real easy for us to go, well, they got 24-hour care, they don't pay attention to when I come and when I go, and it sounds like that's not true.
That is definitely not true. You know, if we have something going on, if there's a change in patient status, and we know that Nurse Nancy, I don't want that in a derogatory way.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we've got, we actually had a Nurse Nancy. if we have Sarah, the nurse is supposed to be coming at 10 o'clock and it's 9:15, we're not going to call over to the office and say, hey, we got this going on, because we know the nurse is coming.
Right.
Well, if 10 o'clock comes and goes, 11 o'clock comes and goes, 12 o'clock comes and goes, we're kind of missing the golden opportunity there to get things done with a patient. If you call in and, hey, I was supposed to be there at 10, I got hung up, I'm going to be there at 1. Okay, that's good. I just want you to know that this is going on with your patient right now. Is there anything special you want us to do? Do you want us to... you know, make arrangements to have the lab stuff available for you, or do you want us to get a UA? Do you want us to pre-medicate, stuff like that, to help make the job easier for the hospice nurse?
Right. I think that's interesting. I think while we know that this is their home, we still forget that it's their home. We still forget that just because they do have 24-hour staff in the building, that we're going to have to at some way treat the assisted living facility and long-term care facility, but the assisted living facility staff, we're going to have to treat them like the direct caregivers. Like if those caregivers were living with them and they were in their home and it was just the caregiver, you know, we still need to treat that facility and the staff there with the same kind of respect that we would treat somebody who was living at home with their daughter.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I have had some members at the hospice nursing community request some kind of a support group to help fight burnout. And so I have started 2 burnout support groups at the hospicenursingcommunity.com to help everybody. And so these support groups meet twice a month on the second Thursday and the second Sunday of the month. And so we're going to be doing that. And I wanted to make sure you understood or knew that these will be faith-friendly support groups. And it doesn't mean they'll be preaching or anything strange like that, but I might use devotionals. I might pull something out of the Bible, maybe out of Psalms or something, but just there might be sections of the group that deal with matters of faith. And I hope that is of interest to you. It can be found in the community events section of the community. So if you would consider joining, I think it would help you. It's going to help me. I need it, I think, as much as anybody does. So join a burnout support group at thehospicenursingcommunity.com.
Right. And that's a really important thing, because a lot of the patients on my end of the building don't have family. Don't have family that come and see them. And so we become their surrogate family, and we become very protective of our family. And if we have a nurse coming through the door and isn't genuine and comes through the door thinking that they are the be-all, end-all of hospice and of nursing, we're going to know that right away. We're going to know that, you know, they're not being genuine with us. And if they're not being open about who they are, how can we trust them to be open about what they're going to be doing with their cares? And we've had that happen, where we've had nurses come into the facility and they're getting maybe a 15-minute snapshot of what's going on in this patient's life, what's going on in the facility's life, and they make a snap judgment with that. And in one of the hospices that comes and visits to our facility, we've got a couple of nurses from that hospice that are like that. They come in, they don't talk to the nurse, they don't talk to the LPN. They maybe will say a couple of words to the aide taking care of the patient, and then they make a snap judgment on what they think they're seeing, and they'll call the doctor and request med changes and leave without ever talking to anybody. And all of a sudden we are getting orders on something that's not an issue.
Yeah.
And the one hospice, I'm good friends with their medical director, and actually have his phone number in my cell phone, and I'll call up and say, "Hey, Doc Blah, what's going on here? We've got a stable patient that nothing's going on. All of a sudden we got this orders for this medication." And he said, "Well, I talked with Nurse B and she said blah, blah, blah." And we'll say, "Well, as far as we know, Nurse B wasn't even in the facility today." So those kind of issues create problems with us, and they do create a little bit of hard feeling.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that makes sense. And you know, that's why I check with the nurse first. I see the patient, and then I come back and I just say, "Hey, I found this. Is this something you've been seeing? Here's what we would do. What are you thinking?" And something like that happened just recently, where I kind of thought maybe this would, you know, activity X would be best for the patient. And I had to hunt the facility all over, because the nurse that was working for the day, she was the only nurse for the whole building, because that happens sometimes. It happens in hospice too. So anybody listen to this, don't pretend like we don't have days when we have a nurse calls in and we get a whole bunch of visits and we're running around and hard to find. It happens to everybody in every area of nursing. And I'm glad that I hunted her down, because I wanted to do a procedure or add something. And she was like, "No, we can't do that here yet. You know, these three things need to happen next." And you know, and it's just showing her respect for the building that she's responsible for and treating her like her opinion matters, because it absolutely does. And I know that the next time I visit, she's going to take me that much more serious because I respected her.
Right. I can't disagree with that at all.
Well, let's hit some of these questions. And, you know, this show is going to last longer than many of the shows that I've done. And that's okay, because being a podcast, people can hit pause and come back. So shows can be longer. And we're just going to take our time and let's answer some questions from the community. So I am going to mention people by name. I'm going to leave last names out of respect. But you know, they ask the questions. So we're going to try to answer them. So Teresa in the group asks, why can't any members in an ALF put a bandage back on without having to call us? It's not something that requires a nursing license.
Right. And I want to start this out with a disclaimer that all ALFs aren't alike.
Right.
All hospice services aren't alike. All hospitals aren't alike. And I can speak from my point of view in my own facility and from working in other facilities around my greater community here from beautiful downtown Halo. And the fact of the matter is that even a Band-Aid or an Aleven is a dressing, and unless a staff member has been trained on how to do a dressing, then they're working beyond their scope of practice. Now, when we orient our staff, we cover some of the basic things like a Band-Aid or tubi grips for compression stockings, the compression stockings themselves. They can put small things like that on in our facility. They're not allowed to put on ACE wraps because that requires a nursing judgment on whether they're tight enough.
Mm.
They're not allowed to do a complex dressing change, which is something more than just taking a Band-Aid off and putting a new Band-Aid on. If it requires to be cleaned, assessed, and antibiotic ointment put on, anything like that, then that's considered a complex dressing change. And again, unless they're specifically trained for it, then it's beyond their scope of practice. And some of our newer aides were they weren't getting in trouble, because it's hard to get in trouble with me because I'm more of a person who uses an opportunity to educate and mm-hmm. steer people in the right direction. But the hospice aides were coming in and changing like an Aleven dressing or some of the other ones, the Mepilexes and stuff, because they were specifically trained to do that on that specific patient.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our staff saw that and thought it was okay for them to change a Mepilex. And I came in to do the dressing change and said, who did this? And I'm going to use the name Candy,
mm-hmm.
just because, you know, a name that doesn't depict anybody real. Candy said, well, blah, blah here said that aides can do it. And I said, no, a hospice aide can do it because she was trained for that particular patient.
Mm-hmm.
And she was told, you report to me when you see this, this, and this. I said, you're taking care of 12, 15 patients, whatever. I said, we don't have time to train you on every one of these patients.
Mm-hmm.
So please don't do that again. So,
right.
Scope of practice, it's as real for an aide as it is for an RN.
Right.
If you go beyond your scope of practice, you can get in trouble.
So quick question. And like you said, you know, there's 50 states and we don't know the ALF rules for all 50 states because they can vary. So to a certain degree, I think we should open a lot of this with saying, check with the ALF you're working with, or begin to learn a little bit about what your ALF in your state is allowed to do, because that will help you work with them and have a better understanding. But I'm curious, with at least you're in Minnesota, so we can at least cover one state is that, like, you have your LPN. What hours does your ALF at least have a nurse, you know, RN or LPN? And I don't mean to say aides aren't nurses, but their licensure is not nursing. And correct. So, you know, how does that work? You know, in the middle of the night at 2 a.m., you're not going to have an LPN running around. Is that correct, or am I misunderstanding?
That's correct. And in the state of Minnesota, I can't say what it is exactly. I don't have my Bible of state regulations here, and it would take a long time to find it anyways, because they're self-defeating. I got to tell you that. They're self-defeating. But it says that you have to have X amount of hours of nursing availability every day. Okay. Mm. And even within our corporate system, I'm not going to say the name of
sure.
the company I work for, but we've got facilities. I believe it's in 5 or 7 states. And even though we're a large corporation and we are guided by corporate guidelines, we also are guided by the different state guidelines. And then each community works within their own specific guidelines set up by the clinical services director and our executive director. Mm. So what I do in Virginia, Minnesota, what we do as a standard practice may be different than what they do in Grand Forks, North Dakota, or they do in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or if what they do in Walker, Minnesota.
Right.
You know, each one has different guidelines. And that's important to note, because even within the same system, you're operating under different guidelines. And part of that is not only do we have state oversight, but in some cases we have county oversight as well. Mm. And then there's some municipalities that actually stick their fingers in the pie too. So even though we're not covered under federal regulation, we're still we've still got regulation coming. And we're still accountable to the Minnesota Department of Health, as I learned probably about a month ago. We can talk about that in a little bit here.
Right.
Here,
let's...
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just figured we'll jump on to the next question, which is from Roe. And Roe is curious as to why most ALFs do not try to monitor or chart bowel movements. Especially since it's kind of a big deal with the elderly.
Yeah. My answer to that is we don't do that in the assisted living facility. We do it in our memory care unit. And the aides, actually, when they make their rounds, they do 30-minute rounds. Every resident gets checked on every 30 minutes, which is really quite frequent, but sure. It's a necessity for safety. A lot of the residents there know to go onto the toilet, but they don't know to flush the toilet. And so they're not chasing after residents to try and figure out who's had a bowel movement, who hasn't. And then they just annotate it on there, and anybody who hasn't gone in a certain amount of time automatically gets some milk of magnesia,
right,
or Senna or Colace or whatever the doctor orders. In an assisted living facility, in the assisted living part, our patients are cognitive enough to know when they've had a bowel movement. They can't tell you right to the day or right to the hour, but they say, yeah, I had a bowel movement. I believe it was yesterday. No, I don't feel constipated. No, I don't feel, you know, I don't feel uncomfortable. And if they start feeling uncomfortable, if they come to me and say, you know, I'm straining a little bit and I can't go, well, say, okay, we're going to go ahead and start you on some milk of mag, which is either under their written orders or standing orders or Bisacodyl or whatever the doctor designates for us. They've got that cognition, and it's really not an issue. We as nurses oftentimes get bowel fixation, just like our elderly residents do. And unless they're specifically complaining about something, if their abdomen is starting to swell out a little bit, if we push on their tummy and, yeah, we feel a little bit hard, if we do a good nursing assessment and we find that there's a problem, we'll probably give them a laxative.
What would be your advice to Ro? Because it's obvious in her, she's having some issues in facilities where the memory unit isn't really tracking it at all. And, you know, she's kind of hitting her head up against a wall because the patients are getting constipated. And she's asked the administrator, can we make an exception? And the administrator has said no. And it's hard for you to guess why. Who even knows what city this is in? But would you have any practical advice for her?
I do. First off, let's do a good nursing assessment. Do we got about good bowel sounds in all quadrants? Is the abdomen soft, non-tender? When we do a percussion check on them, do we get a good hollow sound or do we get that dull thud?
Mm.
If we're getting that dull thud in more than one quadrant, chances are we've got some constipation going on. The other thing is to have the physician write for a laxative daily. And I guarantee you that if the laxative is working too well, you're going to hear about that before you hear about constipation.
There you go. So a proactive approach.
Proactive approach.
All right. I had to straighten out a patient this week or last week at an ALF, a memory unit that I'm going to. They don't track bowel movements. They're getting ready to because they're changing over to point click care, I think is the right phrase for it. And they'll be starting to track that now. And more places are. And I think this problem is going to slowly start going away as many more nursing facilities change to electronic EMRs are going to make them do it.
Right.
How about our question from Brittany? And she says, they also can't tell me if my forgetful patients are eating their meal. And this might fall into the same category. What would be your suggestion to a nurse who's really struggling to track the eating habits of her patients?
Okay. Well, what I do know is that we've got a very proactive dining staff. Our dining staff is separate from our floor staff. And they know when a resident doesn't show up, because they track who comes in and who comes out, and they look at it. And if Joe Johnny or Johnny Joe isn't showing up for a meal, for instance, the other day I had a resident that didn't show up for breakfast or lunch. About 12:35, I got an email from our dining services director saying Johnny Joe hasn't shown up for breakfast or lunch today. Is there a problem? Or we've noticed that Ben-Hur has only been eating Jell-O and soft foods. Is he having some sort of oral problem? And I'll go down and see Ben-Hur and see if he's got a sore on the inside of his mouth or maybe a tooth is bothering him or something. That doesn't happen in all facilities. In some facilities, your dining staff is also your kitchen staff, depending on your size. As the pandemic hit and staffing needs became more acute, some jobs were combined in some facilities. Our big thing is that we can't run two dining rooms, and so we're running three shifts of dining, which keeps our existing staff hustling, but it's working for us.
Right.
And so there again, good nursing assessment. If you've got a resident who is suddenly starting to lose weight, if they're someone who can't get on a scale, do mid-arm, you know, upper arm circumference checks every week. You know, look at them. Is their skin starting to hang on them? Are there starting to get sallow cheeks, stuff like that. You know, nothing beats the good old Mark 1 Modification 3 eyeball in looking at our patients. If you're doing more than just a cursory nursing assessment, you're going to catch some of these things.
Well, and I think it's important for us to remember that ALFs and long-term care facilities are different, and most states require long-term care facilities to weigh patients monthly and document intake and things like that, and the ALFs are not required to do that. And and it might be a little unfair for us to be pressuring them to perform tasks that are outside of their function as a facility. And some people may be listening to this right now, and they're yelling at their speakers, going, James, then this patient shouldn't be in that facility. And so we may jump here just a hair, but I think it's important for us to talk about how you and your organization, because I think many long-term, if we're going to find something that happens all over America, pretty consistent in assisted living facilities, it's that as a patient declines, the ALF tends to want to keep them there, even though their needs are increasing. Help me and our listeners understand why that happens.
I'm sitting here with a big smile on my face.
I know you are.
Chuckling a little bit.
I know you are. And, I know what you're going to say. And I'm glad you're going to say it.
Right. Well, these residents choose where they want to live. That's the first thing. They choose to be in an assisted living. And as I said earlier, the staff of the assisted living become their families. They're concerned about them. They're concerned about their basic daily needs. They're concerned that they're getting enough to drink. They're concerned that they're isolating themselves instead of doing activities and stuff like that. It used to be 20 some years ago, assisted livings, when the resident became more than a assist of one with transfers, they were automatically transferred, you know, the family, and if the family wasn't there, the social workers for the county or whoever's watching over them, guardians or whoever, would search for a facility for them, a long-term care facility to move them to where they had the wire lifts, the Sally stand-ups, stuff like that. And an interesting thing happened along the way. Assisted living facilities started to bloom. There started to be more of those. And the skilled nursing facilities, long-term facilities, started closing beds for whatever reason. For cost, it's very expensive to run a skilled nursing facility, very expensive to pay your staff, very expensive to feed everybody, to heat the building, to cool the building, pay the electric bill. And they started looking for ways to cut costs, or maybe to make the facility more pleasant for their prospective patients. It used to be two in a room, no exception. Okay. And all of a sudden people were moving into these beautiful, luxurious assisted living buildings. And I'm not going to lie to you, these new ones are just fantastic. I mean, you walk into them. Our facility is 21 years old. And you walk through the door and you could have swear it was built last year.
Mm-hmm.
They keep maintenance up on it, and that's kudos to our maintenance staff.
Right.
But the early assisted livings were no better than the older nursing homes. And in fact, some of the old nursing homes turned into assisted livings. Mm-hmm. Dreary, dumpy, nasty looking places. And so they started to do facelift of the facilities. And when they did that, going from two beds in a room to one bed in a room, it cut down on the amount of beds. And a county at one time may have had 3,500 skilled nursing beds. All of a sudden, they're down to maybe 2,100.
Mm.
And there's no place to put people. And so the assisted livings, who were actually designed to be assisted livings and, you know, help people out that had needs, all of a sudden there was no place to put these patients.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to start fulfilling a greater role. Okay. Now all of a sudden we've got patients that are starting to fail. And hospice in assisted living facilities was not really a thing when I first started nursing. Mm-hmm. I remember my first time I went into my current facility, I went into the memory care, and there was a little aide who went running down the hall in front of me saying, "Hospice is here, hospice is here." And it's like, oh my God, am I the assisted living police or something? I mean, they were just so excited that they had a hospice nurse there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, these residents had greater needs, started having residents coming in that had mental health issues. And there again, that's all part of my story here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started having higher acuities. Well, we started having people that were failing and not having beds in a skilled facility to go to. We know they're failing. We know that they're going to probably succumb to their disease. What do? You don't call Ghostbusters. You call 1-800-HOSPICE. And we started bringing hospice people in. And in a facility where we maybe had 2 or 3 hospice patients, all of a sudden we've got 15 or 18 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear that today. We see it in the comments. You know, we go into a ALF or we go into a skilled nursing facility, and that facility relies on us to give a bed bath. Mm-hmm. Well, knock, knock, Puddinhead. You know, hospice is services plus.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that might be offensive to somebody, that they may think I'm talking personally to them.
I think you're fine.
Hospice is added services to the assisted living facility. I'll give you, for instance, we have a resident right now who's been bouncing up and down in her transition.
Mm-hmm.
And is actually getting 2 baths from hospice and just 1 bath from our staff.
Mm-hmm.
Because she likes having the hospice baths better because the aide has more time to spend with her.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
When a hospice nurse comes in, they normally have more time to spend with them. I overheard a conversation the other day, and my office is by the way, I've got a corner office with a window, but the corner is on an inside hall of the of the building, and my window looks out over the halls so I can see what people are doing. But right across from my office is, it's called the game room. It's where people sit and play cards and read newspaper and stuff. And it used to be an empty place where nobody would ever come, and it's a bustling activity all the time now, to the point I have to close my door sometimes. But I overheard this the other day, and they were saying, you know, if you got a problem, you go talk to that Brian Hopkins guy, because he takes the time to listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, where did I learn to do that? I learned to do that in hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I have to scramble a little bit at the end of the day to get my tasks done, or I have to work over a little bit. But if they know that you're listening and you're going to do something about their problem, they're going to trust you.
Yeah.
And that's the same with the hospice nurse. And we, as hospice nurses, I still consider myself a hospice nurse, and I've got the hospice heart, and I help out with another hospice that is just a startup. They come and talk to me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we, as hospice nurses, have got to learn to take that extra 10 minutes in our visit just to listen to them.
I love it. I just love it. And take that extra 10 minutes to listen to the staff at the facility who's the family members, you know, there.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never liked the idea of pressuring families or anything to move a patient from an ALF into a long-term care facility as they're declining, because I would prefer to up what we are doing in that facility for the patient one way or the other, to help meet those needs. And I'm of the belief that neither long-term care or ALF are staffed in a way to handle a lot of patients who are dying all at once. That's why Medicare lets us go into those places, because in the last 6 months of life, the needs are really, really, really high. And so we have to be able to go in and care. The facility needs us, but they need us in a way that is collaborative and friendly. It's, you know, a handshake in and out every day because we're both trying to take care of the patient. But as hospice providers, we do have more time to spend than facility staff usually does, you know, and it's because we're running into an acute situation for a patient, and they ought to be able to stay in their home and not get shipped off to a place where nobody knows them.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
If you are new to hospice or considering hospice, then in September of 2022, I created the website for you. I created thehospicenursingcommunity.com. What started out as a simple community has become a large library of video trainings. Thehospicenursingcommunity.com now has over 45 video coaching sessions covering subjects such as bedside charting, the hospice comfort kit, the four levels of care, how to interview for a hospice job, and so much more. I just completed a 7-part series for case managers, and I'm getting ready to start a series on the PPS scale. TheHospiceNursingCommunity.com is available for just $4.99 per month for full access. Head over to TheHospiceNursingCommunity.com for hope, help, and encouragement. And remember, hospice nursing doesn't get easier. You just get better at it. So let's get better at it together.
Right. And I've got two things to say on that. First one, I want to give kudos to my staff in the facility because they just do such an exceptional job working with hospice patients and the families. And the families that do come and visit are so appreciative of it. My staff, a lot of them, the first time they encounter a hospice patient, it's like, I didn't sign up for this. Well, why don't we just try this and see what happens and see how you feel in 2 weeks? And at that end of 2 weeks, they say, you know what? We're really doing things for this patient. And so kudos to my staff on that. The other thing I wanted to say is that I've been noticing in the post in our group that a lot of nurses are saying that they're required to make 2 and 3 visits to every patient every week. And I just can't figure that out. If you've got a stable patient in a facility or a stable patient at home, your primary job is to teach that caregiver in the home how to take care of their loved one so that they don't have to rely on you all the time. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't have the hero complex where we're going to go in and fix everything for that family. We should be going in and educating the family and giving them confidence so that when there's a crisis and you get the phone call at 2 a.m, as often happens, my husband is having trouble breathing. He's really struggling. He's starting to turn blue a little bit. And you say, remember how I taught you how to give that morphine a few weeks ago? Well, yeah. And you've given it a couple times since? Yeah. Well, I want you to give that morphine. And then if I'm not there yet and it's been an hour, if he's still struggling, go ahead and give him another dose of morphine. And they often say, you know, I'm trying to do the best I can. And my line coming back is always saying, you're not trying, you're doing, and you're doing a good job. And we give them the confidence so that when the end of life comes, we're not stepping in with a cape and a big S on our chest to save the day. We're coming in and saying, you know what? You did such a good job taking care of your husband. When he's gone, I know you're going to do such a fine job taking care of yourself.
Very good.
You're looking beyond the death.
And it's interesting you're talking about having a hero complex because, you know, that's something I've talked about on this show before and done entire shows on not trying to be a hero all the time, not being the center of somebody else's story. And that's kind of right. What you're talking about there. It's really good.
Right. Well, it's their story.
Yeah.
It's not my story. It's their story, and it's theirs to close on their own.
Right. Well, okay, so because we're at an hour and 11 minutes, because you and I like to talk, you're a great storyteller, so the listeners to this show are going to absolutely love all this content. I think it's really helpful, but it also, I feel like, helps us understand the other side, because we get so focused, I think, on some of the negative things or the challenges we're having, we forget the heart of the staff on the other side of the glass, so to speak, and the ALF. Right. So I wanted to end our question and answer with this question from Kay, who asks, thinking of your best hospice company and your best hospice nurse you've ever had. And she asked for three qualities each had. And if you're able to do three, that's great. But I kind of threw this at you at the last minute because I found it. You know, what stood out that made you feel safe and assurance with your residents' care? And I like Kay's question because she's turning the responsibility back onto herself. Rather than expecting something special from the facility or the nurses or from whoever, she's saying, what is it you're seeing that serves you and your patients the best? Because she wants to know what that is so she can be that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about hospices first, the actual agency. The most important thing is accessibility. If I've got an issue going on with a hospice patient, I want to be able to pick up my phone, call the agency 24 hours a day, and within 5-10 minutes, get a phone call back from either the case manager or the on-call nurse or whoever, who is ready to listen to what's going on and not make foregone conclusions in their mind, and then give direction to us on what they want done. That is the most important thing, is accessibility. To know that there's someone on the other end of the phone line.
Mm-hmm.
Me being an RN on day shift, it doesn't matter so much, because if I don't hear back from you, I'm gonna do what I think is best for our patient. I say our patient because we share it. Mm-hmm. And if it's not the right thing, well, it's what we do to make sure that the patient is comfortable.
Right.
The second thing for a company is to stand by your word. If you have admin nurse, or in larger markets, if you have a marketer that makes a promise, stand by that promise. Marketers, if you're out there, I apologize. There's good marketers and good bad marketers, just like every other profession. Some marketers and some admin nurses, when they're doing the screening, they promise the moon. Oh, yeah, we're going to pay for all your medication. We're going to provide all of your DME. We're going to provide all of your supplies, wound care supplies, adult diapers. We're going to bring suction into your home. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And then when they get them into the service, they said, we never say that. We need to have them follow through on what they're saying. And the third thing is, when you have your staff come, have them come with an attitude of, how can I help you? Because we are, as a facility, are your client as much as the patient is. Come in trying to see how you can help us. And I guarantee if you do that, we're going to try and figure out ways we can help you.
Right.
Now, as a hospice nurse, the great hospice nurses build relationships. I think of one of the facilities that I went to, three-story facility, had a nurse's station on the first floor that had three RNs in it. This nurse's station on the floor that had two RNs on it. I would stop at local gas station that had a reputation for good coffee. I found out what kind of coffee they liked. It's no big deal to bring five cups of coffee into a facility. if they've got donuts on sale, bringing those in too. Sitting down, having a cup of coffee with them, a donut, talking about, you know, how their day is going, what's tough, what's not tough. Is there anything I can do to help you out on that? At the same time, I don't forget the LPNs. Finding out what they like, doesn't hurt to bring in a bag of candy every once in a while, or some fat pens. Everybody loves fat pens. I could walk into a facility with 30 fat pens and they'll be gone in 2 minutes. And the AIDS, we can't forget about the AIDS either. Every once in a while, bring in a big box of donuts or whatever, or say a box of ice cream bars or something. It doesn't have to be expensive. It doesn't have to be big. You're not bribing them. You're just saying, hey, I appreciate you. This is just a little token of my appreciation. So come in and build those relationships. Find out what they need. I can confess this now because I've been gone from my old agency for a while. If I had an extra bag of adult diapers that have already been stricken from the book for whatever reason, and they're having trouble getting a bag of adult diapers of that size for whatever reason, you know what? They were going to go into the dumpster anyways. There's nothing wrong with them. They haven't been opened. They've just been in my car too long, and they've been circulated out of the inventory. I just give it to them. You know? I think the statute of limitations have run out. I don't know. But, you know, that's just a little thing. I'm in doing wound cares, and I bring my own supplies, and they say, you know what? We're using our supplies. We're burning up our stock because we're having to change these dressings more often than we thought. For God's sake, give them the supplies they need. You know, make sure they have what they need. Mm-hmm. Be honest. Be forthright. Don't come in with an attitude. If you come in with an attitude, we're going to spot that right away. And we're going to shut right down, and you're going to walk out thinking we've got an attitude. try not to make it happen, but if you give it, you're going to get it.
Body language is a thing, isn't it? You can tell.
It is.
I used to work with a nurse, and if she's listening to this, you know who you are, and you know I love you. But if she heard something she didn't like or they disagreed with her, she'd make this face and go, okay. And it was just so dramatic, she just set people off. And she knows I love her if she happens to hear this. Probably not. But if she did, she knows who she is, and she'd laugh and tease me right back. But she set people off like that sometimes because it was just obvious she didn't think they were right, and it kind of made them feel kind of dumb. And she had to work through that, and I tried to help her, and we made some progress with that. But it's a thing. So I hopefully, Kay, that some of that is useful for you. Kay, I really appreciate your what? I appreciate her spirit in asking that question because it was one of the most how can I be better questions that was asked. And I'm not belittling anybody who asked questions because some of this stuff can be frustrating when we're trying to care for our patients and we feel like we're getting roadblocks thrown up in front of us, whether it's intentional or not. It is a thing, and you can develop a lot of conflict between yourself and the facility. And I've talked before on this show about how conflict erodes influence, and it's our goal to have as much influence with everybody around us as possible. And the more respectful we can be in the facility towards the staff there who are trying to do their job as best they can in a challenging situations, just like we face as hospice nurses, building those relationships and being respectful of the people around us will take us much further than trying to maybe flex our muscles.
Mm-hmm. And then the last thing is that you don't come into a facility and make assumptions about things. Listen to the staff and trust what they're telling you. And I'm going to give you just a real short story here. I had a patient on hospice services, hospice XYZ, and the hospice nurse that came into the facility was actually a friend of mine. And for some reason, over the year and a half, I don't know if she was getting burnt out. I know there was stuff going on with her husband. Her husband was developing cancer and going through all of that stuff. But anyway, she'd come in and she would have the attitude, and she was starting to make assumptions, especially with one patient in particular. And we would discuss things, and she continually accused the staff of not changing the resident's brief. Oh, the brief has never changed. I think she's been laying in this soiled brief, this wet brief, since midnight, and we're talking about 1-2 in the afternoon. But yet there was never a skin problem. The bed was never wet, anything like that. Well, one day I was working with another resident, and I heard myself overhead paged to get to this room stat. And this particular nurse from XYZ agency was in there just throwing a fit. I came in here and her brief was wet, and I said, well, congratulations. It means her kidneys are working. I mean, she pulled me off an emergency for this. And she said, well, I'm thinking about filing a vulnerable adult report
on
you.
Oh, my gosh.
I said, for a wet brief? She said, yeah. And my aide was standing there, and she was trying her best to appease this nurse. Mm. And I looked at her, and I said, Brandy, of course, not the true name. I said, when's the last time you changed her? I changed her at 1 o'clock. Well, it was 1:45. Mm-hmm. And this nurse said, well, there's no brief in the trash can. I said, that's right, because my aides changed the trash can after they put a dirty brief in it.
So the place doesn't smell like urine.
Right. And I said, well, let's look at her. Well, took her covers down, opened up her brief. I said, is there any skin breakdown here? No. Is there any redness? No. Is there any smell? You know the smell of old urine. Mm-hmm. You know the smell of old BM. I said, is there any smell here? No. And I lost it. I looked at her and I said, blah, blah, you just pissed me off. And she said, well, good. And then I think she realized what she said and what she's been doing. And she left there and she wouldn't even talk to me. Mm. And the next two times she came in, she wouldn't even talk to me. I think she was afraid I was going to call her services director and make a complaint against her. But I didn't do that because allowing her to stew and worry about it, I thought was
enough
punishment enough. And it that broke a relationship that we had. We're still friends. Mm-hmm. But when she comes in to talk to me about hospice things, she's very careful about what she says now, and she doesn't make assumptions anymore, and she doesn't have mm-hmm. the attitude anymore. And actually, shortly after that, we started moving away from XYZ company mm-hmm. and getting more patients on ABC company, because a couple of the nurses with XYZ were having these attitudes and doing these snapshots mm-hmm. and stuff, and it really hurt. It hurt their reputation, so to speak.
I think it's important for all of us to realize that how we treat our counterparts on the other side is just so very, very, very important, and to not. I really appreciate you bringing out the importance of not making assumptions, and something that's been kind of, you know, a quote that I just kind of have in my head that has been forefront in my life right now, just for some things that are going on or whatever, is that we find what we're looking for. And if you're going into an ALF trying to find how they have messed up and created problems, you're going to find them, even if you have to make up scenarios in your head. But right. If you're walking in the door believing that this organization is doing the best they can for the patients under their care, then you're not going to make those negative assumptions. You're going to assume that they probably changed it, but guess what? This patient is incontinent, and it doesn't take a whole lot of urine for her to soil a brief. And you're there to take care of the patient, not figure out what everybody else on the other side is doing, because that's an exercise in futility. And if that's all any of us do, then we're all just going to be fighting, and the patient is the one who suffers in the middle of all of that.
Right. And one thing I want to say here, I know we're getting ready to wrap up, and it's hard to believe we've been here almost an hour and a half, and we still have a whole bunch of questions, so we may end up doing another ALF.
I think we will.
If we get enough
interest. We're going to have
to. Yeah. The one thing I want to say is I want you to know that the people who are living in their ALF, except, you know, someone who was placed there because they had no place to go and it was the only one that was available, but those people are there. They're happy. They're being taken care of. If they weren't there, think about where they might be,
mm-hmm.
because there aren't skilled beds available. There aren't boarding houses available like there used to be. They may end up living in a shanty, so to speak, mm-hmm. without running water, without services. A lot of people who live like that fall through the cracks. City services, county services, state services just don't seem to find their way there. Our people who are working there want to work there. Our building has been open for over 20 years. We've got, I think, 6 or 7 employees who've been there the full 20 years. A lot of them have been there in excess of 15 years. We hired a new RN not too long ago, but I'm the youngest, RN manager. And by the way, I take care of 65 patients, if anybody's wondering.
Wow.
I'm the youngest there as far as longevity, and I've been there for 3.5 years. And I went there because I wanted to. The next youngest has been there, I think, 8 years, then 11 years, then 14 years. So they've been there for a long time. They know what they're doing. I feel like a babe in the woods sometimes because I'm still learning.
Well,
and I've been a nurse almost 30 years.
Right. Well, for our listeners out there, I've got even more I was going to plan to say today, but we're not going to worry about that for now. But I hope that this episode has maybe opened everybody's eyes a little bit. And I know that there's, we don't have a magic pill that we can hand out to everybody. If you just swallow this magic pill, you'll have all the answers to solve all of your problems. But I think we need to, as hospice nurses, maybe after you listen to this episode and you start walking into your ALFs, start opening and maybe opening your eyes and considering all of the moving parts that are in there, and let's all try to be less, I don't know what the right word is, whether it's judgmental or let's start looking to find different things. I said sometimes you find what you're looking for. Let's start trying to look for the positives and not become overly accusatory of our counterparts on the other side, because I really truly believe that nobody is in this work who doesn't want to do it. Nobody is taking care of our aging population because they're forced to do it. They're there because they want to be. And all of us are flawed. All of us have our own challenges to being professionals. We have our good days and our bad days. We have days where we are the most attentive and accomplish a lot for our patients, and we have days where we don't accomplish as much. And somebody may come along and give us a 15-minute snapshot and go, well, that's not a very good nurse. Because we have our imperfect days. We all do, right?
Right. And I sit there and chuckle when I hear people ganging up on other nursing disciplines. You know, went into this med-surg unit or whatever, or went into this skilled nursing facility, and all those nurses are, you know, name your poison. And I've even said it a couple of times in posts, and Chris has kind of not really spanked me, but said, you got to be careful about how you say this. You know, but I want to say, you know, you're talking trash about these other disciplines. You don't want to hear what they're saying about some of you guys. So all I can do is urge you guys to keep that humble hospice heart. And that's a very distinctive part of being a hospice nurse. And come on in. If you come into my facility, I'll give you a cold Coca-Cola or a really bad cup of coffee. and we can sit down and talk for a few minutes. Like I said, there's a startup hospice, and the nurses come down and talk to me all the time. I go down to their office and talk all the time.
Yeah.
And it works out well. I guess my time is up. Thanks, James.
Well, I am kicking the closing music on for us just to kind of help us. I can't think of a better way to have wrapped up this show than what you just said. And talking about, that's absolutely building relationships. And so if somebody is listening to this and they're like, well, I wish my ALF would prepare a cup of bad coffee for me when I show up to see the patients. Well, why don't you start by bringing the bad cup of coffee and hop in and visit with the DON and ask her, how can I best help you today with this patient? You know,
that's right. But make sure you call first.
Call first. Right. I'll tell you what, I wake up every morning and I ask myself, how can I be of service to all of these patients and family members and staff today? Like, I just see myself as a servant of all. How can I lift their day? How can I maybe get the med tech to laugh or to have just one single moment where she forgets about how hard this job can be? And if I can do that, then I feel like I've had a successful day. And I just want to see them smile because I recognize that it's hard. This work is hard for all of us. Caring for the aging population is not easy work at all. So I want to thank everybody for taking the time to listen to this. It was a long one, but a really good one. I want to thank Brian for taking time out of his busy schedule to be here. Don't forget that you can call and leave a voicemail at 816-834-9191. And then don't forget to email me at james@confessionsofahospicenurse.net. And so I plan on getting us back on a better schedule and releasing the first and third Sunday of the month because I got away because life got busy. But hopefully I can get back to a tighter schedule and we can get more episodes out. Brian and I are going to probably end up doing a couple more episodes when we can work it together. Looking forward to it.
Sure am.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Thanks for having me, James, and I sure appreciate it. And you have a good evening.
All right. You too.
Take care now, my friend.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So everyone who's listening, thank you once again for being on the show here. And we look forward to the next release. Appreciate you all. And I hope you have a good day wherever you're listening to this. So this has been episode 15 of the Hospice Nursing Podcast for August 7th, 2022.